This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we get an update on a local couple trying to hike 2,600 miles from Mexico to Washington. We give you part two of our interview with the youngest person and first woman ever to lead the Nez Perce tribe. And geologists say that the catastrophic eruption of the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii should serve as a wake-up call for all of us here in the Pacific Northwest. And now, we go inside the Compass. Two months ago, Mike and Elaine Raymond, a retired couple living in Port Ludlow, left their home for a little hike on the Pacific Crest Trail. They're still out there on the trail, and they don't expect to get home until sometime in September. Since we interviewed the Raymonds on KPTZ back in April, they have been posting occasional blog entries online about their adventures. And we thought you might like to hear about how they're doing. I'll read one of their latest blog posts in a moment, but first, we'll let you hear Mike and Elaine in their own voices from that April interview. Mike, you just retired from a long career as a Chimicum elementary school teacher, so now you can relax and take it easy. Why in the world would you decide to spend 5 months walking in the mountains from California to Washington?
Well, we've always really enjoyed outdoor challenges, and we have done a lot of outdoor challenges together. So this is our next one. We've been talking about this for how long?
Oh, at least 15 years. It is, we kind of talk about what is it that draws us out there. And there is something that is just very, especially when you're working, it's very peaceful to just focus on the very basics of food, water, sleep, and just keep walking. That's all of your concerns out there. All of the other things of life just tend to fall away, and you just focus on those very basic things of life, and it's very satisfying.
Basic things like survival.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think it's very mentally restoring.
So here's a taste of how it's going for the Raymonds in their own words. Day 34. Mile 566. Everything had gone so well until now. It all started 2 days earlier when we arrived in Hikertown and Bob wasn't there. No one knew where he was. He was the caretaker of Hikertown and he would be able to get us our resupply box that he had locked up. When we got back, Bob was there, but there was no way to get our extra food back to the store where they would send it on for us to Tehachapi because Bob couldn't, and Vaughn the shuttle driver couldn't, because he'd had a martini. But young dreadlocks girl in the next cabin said she'd be happy to, the next day, since she was going to hang out there. Okay, we're trusting dreadlocks. Will our box be there in Tehachapi in 3 days? Will our Amazon order for a fuel pump and selfie stick arrive on time? The simple answer, no. We repacked on the side of the road and then walked down the same trail where Reese Witherspoon started her hike and the filming of Wild, the story about Cheryl Strayed's hike of the Pacific Crest Trail. 5 miles up, we camped in Juniper Cave at about 8 p.m., with nothing we had expected. We had been at wit's end in Tehachapi, but we would not be denied our miles for the day. On day 35, we marched for 20 miles to find a rough campsite just off the trail. We named it Camp Poodle Dog. Why? The poodle dog bush is a loathed plant in Southern California. It can cause serious skin irritations and intense blistering if one comes into contact with it. Our camp was surrounded by it. Day 38 started with a 1,500-foot climb of Skinner Mountain and then long, gentle traverses until our descent to Walker Pass. We were greeted with cold beer and friendly hikers. Clouds were building quickly, and we set up our tent just in the nick of time as a thunderstorm plowed over us and dumped some very welcome rain for the high desert. We have now journeyed 650 miles and have nearly come to the end of what most consider Southern California. KPTZ will keep an eye on the Raymonds in their quest to conquer the Pacific Crest Trail, and will update you on any newsworthy incidents. The catastrophic eruption of the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii should serve as a wake-up call to all of us living in the Pacific Northwest, because we are sitting right on the Pacific Ring of Fire, a global range that includes many of the world's most dangerous volcanoes. Yes, it could happen here. Bill Chadwick, a volcanologist with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Society, said the Kilauea eruption could last weeks, months, or even years. Imagine if that happened at Mount Rainier, Mount Baker, or Mount St. Helens. The U.S. Geological Society says those three mountains are among 50 volcanoes that are rated high priority for possible eruptions in Washington, Oregon, California, Alaska, and Wyoming. Maximilian Dixon, who manages the Volcano, Earthquake, and Tsunami programs for the state of Washington, spoke to KPTZ recently about the chances of an eruption like Kilauea right here.
Well, considering the fact that we have five of the highest risk volcanoes in the country, in Washington state, we've got Mount Baker, Glacier, Rainier, Adams, and Helens. And we have a pretty good percentage of, in our lifetimes, having an eruption of some sort. But the thing is about that, we cannot predict what type of eruption it's going to be. We just don't understand the science enough yet. We don't have enough monitoring stations to really kind of tell, and we haven't seen enough in our lifetimes to be able to record the data, to be able to really have a grasp on what type of eruption or how big or what types of, you know, impacts are going to be until things start happening.
Do volcanoes tend to warn you by sputtering, or like did Mount St. Helens give a clue that something was going to happen?
Yeah, there's a few ways that you get some indicators that something might happen. So one of them is earthquakes. So having a clustering of earthquakes where magma is actually moving up through the crust and forming a dome or moving some way up from the bottom or from the middle of the earth. Oftentimes you get a cluster of earthquakes, and then that will give you some sort of sign that that activity is happening. Another way is when you have the release of certain gases. So they measure the release of different types of gases through the volcano, and that will give them indicators on kind of what's happening below the earth. And then the other monitoring that they do is for deformation. So if you have, say, a movement and like a bubbling or sort of a bulging, I would say, of the mountain, that is a really good indicator. There's a lot of pressure happening and something is going to happen eventually. Yeah, so those are kind of the three indicators that they use for warning signs and trying to figure out, you know, is there going to be volcanic activity? How bad might it be? And just kind of a time frame.
You mentioned several volcanoes in our area that are, I guess, still considered active. Are any of them of more concern than another in terms of potential?
Mount Rainier has the highest population density near them, closest to the mountain. So obviously that's our largest concern, just simply because of that, and also because of the mud flow, the lahar that came off of Mount Rainier and went all the way down to Tacoma. You know, obviously that is a big threat. So lahars, they move at a really fast pace, and they're like a wall of concrete. So we have some lahar warning systems in the town of Ording, and I think we have 29 sirens in Pierce County. So we're trying to expand that. We're also trying to, I think Pierce County and USGS is trying to add more seismic monitors so that we can have a better idea of when a lahar might be triggered. We can also warn people in a more effective manner. I would say Mount Rainier, just simply because of population.
You used a word I'm not familiar with, lahar. What is that exactly?
Yeah, so a lahar is when you have on the side of a volcano the melting of water or the rapid melting of water, either from hot magma or gases coming up through the crust, or you have some sort of combination of saturated soil that reaches the capacity where it can no longer hold itself, and then it comes down the side of the mountain and it moves probably, you know, 20, 30, you know, miles an hour, or if not faster. And they can be just literally walls of mud that are, you know, 20 to 40 feet high.
What what a worst-case scenario volcano eruption looked like from Mount Rainier, especially with all those people in that general vicinity?
You know, it's really hard to say what a worst case would be, because we honestly have not witnessed nor recorded a worst case that I'm aware of. Now obviously, Mount St. Helens was a very tragic incident, and we had a lot of loss of life. In a way, we really didn't know that there was going to be that loss of life, because we didn't understand at that particular time that a volcano could blow out sideways. We just didn't understand that that was the threat that we were facing. And so we learned a lot from that eruption. You know, in a sense, a lateral explosion or eruption is a really bad thing. But I would say a lahar in the middle of the night, that's a really bad case. As far as ash goes, depending on where the wind's blowing, it's not going to be that much of a problem, especially on the western side of Washington.
There are things that people can do to prepare for an earthquake to some degree, and even for a tsunami. How about a volcano? Is there anything you can do to protect yourself or get prepared for the event of an eruption?
Well, the good thing about an eruption or a volcanic event is that you usually have some warning time. So a week, maybe a month, maybe several months. That's the good thing, where we can usually have time to warn people to be able to evacuate them. Now, whether we can actually convince everyone to evacuate, that's a whole different story. But at least we can warn everyone, and we can do our best. So we have some time to do that. For protective actions, I would say that just, you know, when you get an alert, so always have your NOAA weather radios handy, pay attention to the news. And when we alert you and say, hey, this is a danger, and we pick, you know, figure out the air danger area and you fall within that, and we're giving you, your local emergency managers or whomever is in charge is giving you this information to be able to evacuate so that we can make sure that you're safe, please just listen. You know, follow that advice. Be prepared to do that. And also, for ash, I would say, you know, if it's a really bad situation, you know, learn about how to shelter in place to keep ash out of your house. Also, you know, there's a lot of great, you know, just wearing N95 masks to protect your lungs, being able to learn how to properly put them on. So we call PPE, personal protective equipment. So just learn how to put those on and be aware of the quality, air quality. And also, I would say just be mindful when you're on the mountains and you're like camping or hiking. Just, you know, pay attention and listen to the park rangers, authorities, so that if they're going to warn you, then you can evacuate. If you live in an area that's at risk of lahars, know your evacuation routes. Know how to get out as quickly as possible. Don't try to drive because the roads are going to be blocked. Practice them as well so that you can get out as quickly as possible, and make sure that you pay attention and have you're signed up for all of your alerting and warning, all the alerting and warning systems. That's going to be able to inform you when, in as quickly as possible, when you need to get out. So definitely practice and get signed up for those. So I would definitely do that.
Do volcanic and seismic events sometimes occur at the same time, with one triggering the other? Could we experience an apocalyptic trio of earthquake, volcano eruption, and tsunami all together in one giant event?
There have been a lot of cases throughout history where a volcanic eruption triggered landslides, and also with the landslides and or the collapse of the volcano have created massive tsunamis. Yeah. And in a lot of cases, earthquakes will be occurring either before the eruption or during the eruption. So you kind of have that trio effect. I want to say that some of the largest, and I mean the highest waves, tsunami waves, have been from landslides that were triggered up to 1,700 feet in Alaska.
Oh, my God.
Yes, higher than the Empire State Building.
Was that the 64
quake? That was not the 64 quake. I think it was 59 in LaToya.
With geologist Maximilian Dixon, this is David Cunningham for KPTZ News.
This year, Rebecca Miles of the Nez Perce tribe paid a visit to our peninsula in honor of the late Billy Frank Jr., Nisqually tribal member and tireless advocate for the environment and treaty rights. Rebecca became not only her tribe's youngest elected chairman, but she was also the first woman chairman of the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee. This is the second installment of our interview with Rebecca Miles. We discuss the waters that flow to and through the Columbia River Basin and how one man's legacy has helped bring us back to renewed awareness of the circle of life.
Since we're talking about water, let's talk about the creatures that dwell in that water. We're actually sitting here on Billy Frank Jr. Day. He was a tireless advocate for Indian treaty rights and environmental stewardship, and his activism paved the way for the Bolt decision, which reaffirmed tribal management of salmon resources in the state of Washington. Where are we with that? And when we talk about salmon resources specifically for the Nez Perce and the Columbia River Basin, we're talking about Chinook salmon. What is the importance for folks out there that are not too familiar with what's happening?
It's a lot like the resource of water, except we're talking about fish. What the United States government quickly found out when they negotiated these treaties with all these tribes, you know, when they came out to basically take our land, was they're very sophisticated. They have their own governments. And so that is the very reason they had to enter into all these agreements, because they weren't going to get anywhere if they had it. One, a recognition of governance in itself. And then they understood there's a governance over the resources that tribes had themselves. And that is now impacting how we govern our resources. And it isn't the sense of everybody comes out and it's just plentiful, full of resources and everybody take. We have to consider the tribal resources. And that's still a battle to this day. So Billy Frank went through probably the most turbulent time, because he says himself, I was the getting arrested guy. Those are the kind of warriors that paved the way for us, that now it's not even a question of those rights.
He was arrested, over 50 times, starting at age 14, right?
Correct. That's correct. What those people were saying in all that generation was, we're simply asking for what you promised us, and that was to have 50% of the harvest. That's all. I think Billy Frank would even say, even now, you would not believe where we are now to see salmon advocates that used to fight now actually are on the same side, because we realize we're fighting over the breadcrumbs. The largest harvester of fish have been the hydroelectric dams. If we put our resources together, what could we actually do? And boom, you see in the 3-4 decades, a place where Indians weren't welcome to fish, very welcome to fish, because, hey, you're bringing money to our little town. You're bringing a resource. We both have 50% of the fish, so we should be arm in arm together. And that's been the change that has happened, and all because of people, especially people like Billy Frank.
What are the salient things that need to be addressed ecologically? I know that Billy Frank Jr. was instrumental in a lot of conservation efforts and discussions along those lines. In your eyes, what is the future? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think those kind of things that have been the problem and kind of slowly seen the obvious. I mean, tribes have already seen how detrimental dams were, but I think we've all kind of wrapped our minds around it and understood, wait a minute now, this isn't just taking from people who fish or the tribes who depend on that fish for who they are, the very fabric of their being. This is now, what do we value and where do we live? The thing that has been so detrimental, and that's something that the tribes have been saying for years. I used to sit on the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. We used to work with Northwest Indian Fisheries. They still do, but Billy Frank used to serve as their chair up until the day he passed. It was getting the government to understand, now we're dealing with this larger beast, and that is climate change. Now you're going to see the scarcity of the resource in such a way that we've never seen. When you have a government that doesn't even allow you to use the word climate change, it's a scary time, because the tribes have always believed the state of our fish, the state of any natural being that the Creator put on this earth, is basically a mirror reflection of what we can expect for ourselves. We must take care of them. We must take care of their health and their survival. Otherwise, we're looking at our own survival.
In that light, because of climate change, we're also having to look at what the environments look like and where can we make sure that they exist for the Chinook to propagate.
The Nez Perce have the largest tribal fisheries program in the country. We've been very successful. We've returned some of these areas of habitat for endangered species into literally pristine condition. That's as far as you can go. I mean, you can do all that, But until you do something about their travel and how they get to those pristine areas, that matters.
And some cold water, right?
That's right. The water must move like a river moves. It can't be slow. There can't be barriers. What's a barrier for one species isn't a barrier for another. And once you clear that barrier, now you're hurting another species like our sacred eel or Pacific lamprey. And we used to say gravel to gravel, but now we say mountaintop to mountaintop, because you think about where these species come from and the little streams that they are born into, and then their plight all the way down to survive and get out to the ocean and come back, you know, as adults to the very same exact stream they were born. That's pretty magnificent, even though they've got all these hurdles now. They have dams, they have predators, they have warmer waters, all these obstacles, the imbalance of what they know.
Let's talk about the necessity of dams. I know that that's been quite controversial. I know that we've had some success here on the Olympic Peninsula. What needs to be done in terms of some of these dams that still exist in the Columbia River Basin?
I think it's been quite obvious. The removal of the lower Snake River dams. We're not going to live without dams. We're not going to live without the dependence on those resources, such as, you know, electricity and other things, even transportation. But when we're looking at, I think over time, enough studies have been done, including the Army Corps of Engineers, whose own engineers agreed that the Snake River dams equal deadbeat dams. They weren't put in for electricity. The amount of electricity they produce is literally lost in the noise. It doesn't go into its own private little bank just for the users there. It goes into the Western grid and it really is meaningless. We have enough wind power in that area to suffice. Also, inland where I grew up and where the Nez Perce tribe is located, we're the furthest inland port in the country, and it has not been this economic boom that it was promised when they were put in. And it was all great at the time, but at the time you're ruining habitat, beautiful white sandy beaches, and you're ruining petroglyphs, you're ruining burial sites, all for the promise of this huge economic boom, which honestly, you read the local paper there and you'll see the comments from people who used to be very supportive of those dams. Look, this has not been the great savior for us like we thought. And our taxpayers are subsidizing the Port of Lewiston, Port of Wilma. And so that promise has not been fulfilled. And people shipping their product now are looking at rail and saying, I'll quietly ship this way. And so then you have to ask yourselves, how important are these dams? They're even behind on maintenance. You think about the cost to some of those schedules to replace many of those turbines are over. They need to replace them now. Why would you put all this money into dams that aren't producing the amount of electricity you need or the transportation you need or flood control that you need? All of those things. I think that's been proven.
And also the Nez Perce have been instrumental not only in preserving the Chinook, but also the Coho, obviously, and just wanted to make sure that people understood that. So the dams, when we get out into the open water on the coast here, we have the orca whales. Their diet for hundreds and thousands of years has been the fatty benefit of the Chinook salmon. This is also a consideration because it looks like as of 2015, the orca has been put on the endangered species list. So what kinds of benefits are you seeing for the orca because of all of the work and all of the conversation and agreements that are happening on the part of the Nez Perce?
I think one of the major things is not even just governments themselves, like tribal governments, tribal organizations like CRPFIC and Northwest Indian Fisheries, the acknowledgement of that circle of life. I think to have the discussion now prevalent in any of the things we do way up there in Lewiston is not done without folks representing the orca. That's wonderful because we don't want to continue down the path like we've doing, like Pacific lamprey, which are not listed. And you sit on this, the chicken before the egg. Do you want the lamprey listed to get caught in the bureaucracy? It's a tough call. And to see the orca listed, you think that's a success. But then how much resource are we going to put toward that? It's a difficult challenge, but I think one, it's good because it's balancing out this circle of life that tribes have always known, that have always understood. And there's so many issues then with not just orca having its part of its food to survive. It's the condition of that food that comes back into the discussion. It's the condition of those fish. And so it highlights the fish to people in a way that they may have not seen them before if they've been, you know, for the orca. You think about all these various policy arenas. And when you can kind of marry up the two, that's a very successful campaign for both species. And so it's really exciting to see when we do efforts way inland on our Chinook salmon to see some of the organizations for orcas come all that way in to understand, hey, we're in this fight together. We have to be in this fight together.
You put it well when you said the circle of life, because that's what it is. These are southern resident killer whales that we're talking about, the orcas, but the resident orcas, and their diet is Chinook. Three of the main reasons for the decline of southern resident killer whales has been lack of sufficient prey, which has been the Chinook, toxins and vessel noise. And so all of these things come into play.
I just can look at even the health of our people. The long drive over, I can think of members of my family struggling with diabetes or struggling with different things. And we're no different than the orca or the Chinook salmon. We're all facing pollutants. We're all breathing in things that are setting our life on a path that we are going to have a difficult time to survive because of the inability of regulation and so forth. Progress is the almighty thing. There's always been this discussion. Yeah, you can do that. That's great. Progress is great. Technology is great. But should you do that? Should you do that? And we've kind of been a country and a world that has just gone head first into everything. And tribes have always had these lessons. If you were to go anywhere in the whole world, the indigenous people, they may seem the most primitive. They actually have been there for thousands of years because they have just this basic teaching in life and understanding. There's a reason why we don't do these things because our survival depends on it. And if we decide to change the way the water works, well, we're changing what the Creator God put there, you know, and that's something we don't do. And that's what I've seen in this administration is it feels almost like we've all lost even just in humanity. But then what has happened is humanity has stepped right up and said, no, we're right here. And it's meant more money for environmental groups. It's meant more awareness from people that may have just kind of been supportive, but just sat there and, oh, we'll let you folks do it. It's meant an uprising of saying, no, we're going to fight for what we value. We're not just going to sit back and let you take it. We're going to fight, and we have to defend our values and our way of life and the environment.
There's a quote from Billy Frank Jr. that I really love, and it's, I don't believe in magic. I believe in the sun and the stars, the water, the tides, the floods, the owls, the hawks flying, the river running, the wind talking. They're measurements. They tell us how healthy things are, how healthy we are, because we and they are the same. That's what I believe in.
That always just touches, I think, anybody who listens and knowing him and how he was raised and everything he believed in. He will always be a giant in everything that we do as a person of humanity and a person to speak for things that can't speak for themselves. And he was probably the best teacher even now that he's gone. He's been a wonderful teacher. So it's been truly an honor and a blessing to be a part of his life.
You've been a good student.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
This is Chris Bricker for KPTZ Community Radio News.
The KPTZ Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and is repeated Saturdays at noon, exclusively here on KPTZ, 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. For the news team here at KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio, I'm David Cunningham.